Howard Mansfield is our guest on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are pleased to have him with us and us with him. I had a young friend, medium young, in her late 20s probably, say something effective. I need to know about when machines are bad. And I said, where do I start? She said, well, you know, we all know that machines are good and that we all need them. But give me a sense, she said, of when we just kind of hit the wall with machines. And I said, you need to know about Howard Mansfield, because much of what you tell us is that we've gotten somewhat distracted, I mean, this is how it sounds to me, by our machines, that in some ways we've almost forgotten who's in charge here. Many of the people, as you talk about restoration, as you talk about renewal, have turned that back around, haven't they?
Yeah, they certainly have a handle on the fact that these are some of also our greatest works, and there's a real genius and a moment of invention, and this great thing that we've done with machinery. And certainly we are overwhelmed by our machinery, and that calls the pace, and that pushes us. And you go to any office, and we all have our heads in personal computers. You go home, they have their heads in their personal computers. And, you know, there was a time when everybody thought the Big Brother, and then everybody said, well, personal computer. So everybody said, oh, it's personal, it's mine, you know. So we bought into it. Particularly I was at an antique gas engine meet. Now, these are these little sort of one-lunger engines. Some of them spin down and then fire up. And have this nice motion. It's sound to them. And they were everywhere on the farm before rural electrification. They were the things you'd take one machine and move it around. And they were built, like, really heavy. And you got them from Sears or you know, Fuller and Johnson, tons of these things. Well, these guys restore them. There's a certain machine literacy, you could say. They're like poets of gears and torque. And you have to admire their, I think, looking for trouble, you know, going to find a machine that has seized up and hasn't started for 30 years and getting it to run, and then just having it run on its own like a piece of kinetic sculpture. I really admired that. And admired the ability to do that. I have someone, you know, wrestling with a lawnmower or a car, as we all do. But I was walking around this field. I mean, this is a whole cow pasture in Vermont, a couple of acres, and there's just a haze of smoke over, like a wreath of smoke. And there's all these machines going, shpock, 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 and a big one going, shpock, 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 and just machinery, moving. And there's one machine there, and it's moving water. It's just endlessly emptying a bucket and then refilling it, emptying it. I thought, hokey smokes. You know what? And people driving tractors around doing nothing. And it's like machines on holiday. And then I thought, well, you know, this is wonderful. It's what we love doing. We're a machine culture. We love machines. We're always thinking, what's the easier way to do things? I'll build a big machine so I won't have to use a shovel. But then I was reminded from the story from the Tao. There's this learned master, as always is in these stories, and he's walking in the country, and he comes across this poor, you know, peasant, and he's carrying these huge jars of water to water his garden and back and forth, and tremendous labor. So the learned master says to him, well, why don't you use shadoof, this kind of pole that's weighted at one end, and it comes in. It's like a seesaw. You can water a lot more your garden. And this peasant says, that would be a contrivance and would take me away from the way of the Tao, the way of simplicity. And the learned master is just hushed into silence and realizes he's been basically out-simpled. And really, when you think about it, what we have is we're really good at creating plenitude, actually at creating wealth, but we've lost another kind of wealth in creating that wealth. We can create material wealth really well. But this other kind of wealth, this fullness, this plenitude, we've lost, and that's the exchange. So we're kind of a one-trick pony for all that. And people are trying to get some way around it to get to the other side of it.
This sounds like I don't know quite how to describe it, a parochial wealth that we have created.
What do you mean?
Just a wealth that does not contemplate everything going on around it that is predicated on some very simple assumptions.
That's true, yeah. It's certainly...
And a bereavement in that. Yes?
You mean the more you have, the less you have?
Sounds that way, doesn't it? Gee, yeah. I don't know.
To put it technically.
Well, that many of these folks of whom you speak, when you talk about those who are restoring, whether they're restoring an orchard,
yeah,
saving seeds,
yeah,
restoring a 300-year-old house. Yeah. Many of these people are, in fact, walking away from the more for the less. Are you preaching to me here? Are you telling me that I need to be learning from this, that I need to be doing this too?
I don't know if I'm preaching. I hope not. But I think your perception about people walking away is exactly correct. I was really impressed with this at the Civil War reenactment. I went down with these guys, some of them were to Antietam. They were reenacting Antietam, the bloodiest day in American history. And they gave me a uniform. They taught me to shoot this black powder gun. And we get on the field, and there's 16,000 guys charging at each other, and there's smoke and horses and in-ground explosions. And it's this huge cinematic scene. And it was like waking up in somebody else's dream. But
and you were in the middle of this.
I was, and then getting wounded was optional, and I would get wounded so I could fall down and take notes. But and someone came over and asked you what kind of wound you wanted. It's silly. It's also an extended meditation on what things were like. It's a way of trying to will yourself back. It's not really about the gunplay for most of them, because some of these guys were cops and National Guard guys. They didn't need to mess around with guns anymore, and they said as much. But what I really came away from that weekend was the campgrounds. We slept in 1861 regulation army tents, these little white tents. My head stuck out one end, my feet the other. And they were on these little main streets that look almost like a street of Greek Revival houses. And here's what struck me about it. It was quiet. Here's a small American city of 16,000 people. There's no machine noise. No one's running to get to the dry cleaning tent. No one's late to the daycare tent. People are sitting around campfires. They're talking. You hear, only in the distance, you hear horses whinnying. You hear someone practicing drums, bugle, and harmonica. And this kind of peace seeps into you. And when I talk to other reenactors, they say, yeah, you know, around night at the campfire, it's so great. So here we are, seeking the turmoil of another era to find peace from our own era. And I find that really disturbing.
Disturbing.
Well, it is. You think about it. If you have to go to the Civil War to find peace.
So
war is peace. You know, it's sort of an upside-down thing.
There is also, and listening to you say that, in a way what you're talking about is a critique on language.
Oh, how so?
We can read about the Civil War.
Yeah.
We can talk about the Civil War. But we can't experience the Civil War. And again, this tangibility to be there, to be in the middle of it.
That's what these guys told me over and over. It was like this whole thing about, they had this expression back in Civil War times that kids would say they wanted to go see the elephant. This was like a whole exercise in building the elephant.
The elephant was the war.
Yeah, the elephant was the war. So here, everybody.
But it was the experience.
People were just trying to will this back and put as much of this back together. Like you say, if you got every detail right, if there were no farbs, as they called them, people had incorrect things in their uniform, which comes from far be it for me to say.
Farbs,
they call it. But if people did it right, then you could kind of will yourself back into that time and almost sense it. That's what they told me. And they told me there were times like, man, they felt it, like they were there.
But the same thing with the airplane. You can read about it,
yes.
You can think about it, and you can. But until you have actually had to work your way through physically the design challenges.
That's just what the restorer told me, the one who did the right plane right. He said, you do the fabrics right, you do everything right, and wham, it's 1910, he said. Just like that. You get the smell of it even. That's what he said. Yeah, that's what they're after.
But a good friend took us to see Ragtime, which is a miraculous bit of theater. It was stunning. It was awesome. By halftime, I was sitting more or less catatonic with tears running down my face, which was not what they had in mind, by the by, because I knew what was going to come in the 20th century. Mm. So all of this elation and ecstasy to go back to 1910,
yeah.
Oops, now you got to live through the 20th century. Isn't there a problem with going to our past to find these ecstatic experiences?
If you go to the past to find that experience and then become an importer, and bring it back and say, this is how we make the present better, then I think you've really closed the circuit. So if you look at the past not as nostalgia, but to be an importer and say, this and this was done right in the past, and this is what we should continue, and this today are good and much better than they were in the past, and thank God we have that.
It's a visceral learning experience, which is a different way of learning than to go back and again, reading the words and hearing someone talk about it. To experience it, you experience things that go beyond or beneath or beside the linguistic representation of those things.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think people sort of sense that in old places. Also, they sense how worn they are. They respond to that.
May I interrupt?
Oh,
please. Okay. We're going to be back in just a minute with Howard Mansfield, and then I won't interrupt. I am Paula Gordon, Bill Russell, and
until
I am pleased.
Time.
Well, until the next time. We are pleased that we are all together in New Hampshire, about which we will also talk when we return in just a moment.